For the record, this is Friday, May the 18th, 1984, and the Alaska Native Review Commission is holding its second day of hearings at Sitka in the A&B Hall, and we're open for business.
My name is Peter M. Huberth, Box 415. In Sitka. I have a few comments to make about ANCSA and possibly some comments about remedies. I don't know whether they're really relevant or not, but I'd like to at least be able to put them on the table. For the record, I'm not an Alaskan. I've lived up here just shy of 8 years, 3 years in Juneau and close to 5 years in Sitka. I worked for Sea Alaska Corporation and was largely responsible for selecting their lands, and then I worked for Alaska Lumber and Pulp, and now I'm between jobs. I came here early enough, 1976, to see some of the initial stages of corporate implementation as the corporations were created under ANCSA. All of them pretty much had been created, however, the real implementation of trying to become a viable entities was really starting about late 74, 75, and getting going in 1976. Being able to see this, I feel that you can say that ANCSA is only partially successful. There is a distribution of money and, of course, a distribution of land. And I feel that the members of Congress from Alaska kind of recognize this. Certainly, Senator Stevens has mentioned a number of times that whenever the natives can get together in concert and determine that a particular amendment is appropriate, if that's a viable political choice for him, he's willing to pursue it. However, when you look at what ANCSA did and listen to the comments that were made last night, certainly a culture shock was created. And it's going to be continuing for quite a while longer. And one of the reasons why it will be continuing, I feel, is because most of the corporations lack an adequate economic base. And if you say that for corporations here in Southeast, and I'm talking about ANCSA-created corporations, I can imagine just what it must be like up in the Kuskokwim and further north and a number of communities in the interior. I feel that Congress should have realized this, and I feel that Congress should take cognizance of it and be amenable to remedies. There are a lot of remedies that can be suggested. I question whether the native communities and organizations can get more land. Perhaps politically that would be too difficult to put across. However, I certainly feel that native for-profit corporations and non-profit corporations, as the terms were used last night, should be able to get financial assistance. I feel that Congress has to be partially responsible for the fact that financial success has been certainly not universal. And the situation such as Sciatica's, which is probably one of the worst situations in the state, certainly has to be recognized. I also feel that financial assistance is appropriate for cultural activities, for training, and things like that. These are more politically amenable, I think, to the political system as we think about it in the United States. And this type of financial assistance can be considered to be even beneficial as far as other citizens in the state of Alaska are concerned because of the bringing in of funds to help create more viable industries, if you will, and better living conditions for people. I also feel quite strongly that, a matter of fact, I really don't understand why sovereignty is such an issue. There's no question in my mind that there should be greater native sovereignty. And I've never been able to understand why people tend to fight that. As far as the tribal courts, things that were mentioned last night by Mr. Brady, and there are certainly other instances. It seems to me as though everyone can gain from allowing greater sovereignty, which in turn, of course, provides for stronger cultural identification and items similar to that. And finally, probably none of this can be attainable unless less bureaucracy is visited upon the native corporations, profit and nonprofit. So those are my remarks. I appreciate the opportunity to share them with you.
I wonder if I could ask you some questions. You said that you were employed by Sea Alaska back in the 70s and largely responsible for assisting them in making their land selections. I got that right, did I?
Yes, sir.
And in what capacity did you do that? Were you their land manager?
I was hired by the corporation to select their lands for them and recommend the selections to the board of directors for approval, and to undertake initial planning to get into timber harvest and related activities. I also worked in the minerals part of it, and then some other items that were very minor.
And what qualifications did you have for that to work?
I have, prior to the time going with Sea Alaska, I had over 15 years of experience in forest management, a couple of degrees in land management, and also some master's work in business administration.
Forgive me, I just wanted that on the record. How many years was it that you were engaged in the selection of Sea Alaska's lands?
The critical period was about a year and a half. The lands, initially, we had to meet a deadline of December 18, 1977, as far as land selection is concerned. This was for all of the regional corporations, the 12 that are in the state, not the 13th region. And therefore, there was a real crunch to obtain the data, make the land reviews, and select the lands giving priorities, because we still don't know, Sea Alaska still doesn't know how many acres of land they're going to actually end up with due to the vagaries of the Act in, I think it's Section 14.
The you mentioned the condition of village corporations here in Southeast, and you said if they're in trouble, what about those village corporations in Kuskokwim? I think you used that as representative of areas of the state where there are no resources to speak of, and so what's a corporation going to do? Would you like to enlarge on that based on your experience here in Southeast?
You
see, up in those other places, they think of Southeast Alaska as village corporations, as the only village corporations with real assets, because they have surface resources, timber, that you don't find in the Kuskokwim. Of course, there, if they have subsurface resources, well, those belong to the regional corporation. So there is a feeling in the other regions that the village corporations are better off in terms of resources here in Southeast Alaska than elsewhere.
I would expect that that's the case. However, Southeast Alaska, partially due to the land suit that was spoken to last night, the initial land suit where there was a $7 million settlement, handy?
The $7.5 million, the old Clinkerton Haida lawsuit.
And because the federal lands in Southeast Alaska are what is called being in a largely a reserved status, that means that they're administered by the U.S. Forest Service and therefore have an administrative entity separate from BLM, which handles miscellaneous lands in the United States. The regional corporation and the village corporations had to be much more selective and were substantially restricted in their selections compared to the interior. In the interior, a village would select a whole township, 36 square miles, in a pattern that was determined in the act and regulations. A relatively small village could end up with, for instance, three townships, I believe, is a minimum. I'm not exactly sure. Whereas down here, it was determined that a village would have 23,000 acres, and that there would be limitations, substantial limitations, as far as the townships were concerned, from which this land could be selected. However, down here, the village corporations could select down to a 40-acre parcel. These are generalizations, but yep. they fit. So that they could be more selective in obtaining timber rights. Some villages, two, to the best of my knowledge, Yakutat and Heidelberg, had a township line go through the middle of the village. You had to select all of the land in the township in which your village was located. Then, and a township is 23,040 acres. So any land, any acreage that was left over because you didn't have to select the salt water, you could then take from adjacent townships. However, if the township line went through the center of the village, as was the case of the Yakutat and Heidelberg, then your village was located in two townships. So that you couldn't, let's say, gerrymander your way around into the better timber, because your land had to be contiguous, except for places where the water, salt water, happened to divide it up, but it was still within township designations. Therefore, at least two of the villages, because of the township situation, couldn't get good timber lands. Or maximize their opportunities. Also, other villages simply didn't have the opportunity to obtain good timber because it wasn't within the area that from which they could choose their 23,000 acres. Certainly, the timber is a lot better than in the interior. If the land had been given to the villages in a timely manner, as was expressed in the act, then they could have taken advantage of a very fine market in the late 70s, which was denied to them because the transfer of land took, I would say, an inordinate amount of time. These villages had largely selected and located their lands by 1976, and yet conveyance didn't take place until 79 at the earliest, and 1980 for a number of the villages. In 80, the market started to go down. It's never come back. So because of the cyclicality and other problems that go way beyond this, such as the value of the dollar, the revenues, as initially hoped for, have been far short of expectations. And the costs have continued to go up so that the margins have really been denied most of these village corporations. And the valuations for a lot of this timber occurred at a time when it was anticipated that the market would generally stay up. So as soon as a number of these corporations went to got their conveyance and went to financial institutions so that they could start to get capital in order to exploit opportunities on the land and also have economic diversification for their shareholders, they went there with the idea that timber values were going to be high, and the financial institutions bought this. Everyone bought this. So that a number of the villages are now visited with significant debts, not like Sciatica's, but still debts that are hard to manage and haven't had the capital to pull out because it hasn't been forthcoming from their timber base. So while they may be better off vis-a-vis interior village corporations, I suspect that they aren't because of the way this financial picture started to evolve.
Well, a common complaint throughout the state is that village corporations are undercapitalized, and I gather that you say that is true in spades here in Southeast Alaska.
It is. If you had 23,000 acres, well, let's put it a little differently. Most of the villages have between 400 and 600 million board feet of timber inventory when their lands were conveyed to them. In order to achieve what we call a sustained yield or managing to for some kind of income on fairly close to an annual basis up here, you can't take out little bits of timber, 2, 3, 4 million feet, so that you can spread your harvest out for 80 years, 90 years, whatever you choose. Probably a minimum amount that you can take out is more like 15 million feet, and then you're not spreading your overhead over a sufficient volume. 25 million feet is probably a better number to use. Well, that means that if you only have 400, you're looking at 16 years of harvest out of an 80-year growth cycle. Yeah.
In Southeast Alaska, the Tongass National Forest, I don't have my map in front of me, but I think the Tongass and the Chugach National Forests more or less encompass virtually the whole of the lands of Southeast Alaska. Is that right?
The Chugach is in what we call South Central. When you take the north-south line between the Yukon and Alaska and extend that south, everything to the west of it along the water is called South Central. Everything to the east of it is called Southeast. Comes pretty close.
Yep.
And in the case of Southeast Alaska, between the Tongass National Forest and Glacier Bay National Monument, I would suspect that substantially over 90% of the land is accounted for. This includes also the national monuments that are within Forest Service jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Which Department of Government administers the Tongass Forest?
United States Department of Agriculture Forest Service.
One other thing, I know you don't. Just for the record, from what universities did you receive your degrees in land management? People are going to be reading this record years from now, and they might as well have that information?
Cornell University and Yale University.
After you worked for Sea Alaska, where did you work then?
Alaska Lumber and Pulp Company until latter part of last year.
And it's been, I take it, very severely impacted by the recession.
They're probably in worse shape than Sciatica, if that's, that puts things in perspective.
Are there any village corporations down here in Southeast with substantial timber assets that are in good shape today? Or let me put it this way.
Yeah, I think there are.
Yes.
I think there are three offhand. It doesn't mean that they aren't saddled with debt, but I think they're managing it well because of various fortuitous things that seem to happen. One you'll hear from in Ketchikan, that's the Cape Fox Corporation. They're the corporation from Saxman, which is tied by a road to Ketchikan. I think they're well managed, and they happened to get their lands early. They worked extremely aggressively to get their lands early, and they started their logging in 1979, and that was very beneficial. Another one is Kvilco, which is located on the Kasan Peninsula, not too far from Ketchikan, and they did a very unusual thing, which was to, one, they have very few shareholders by Southeast standards. They're down in the 60, 70, 80 category, I think, somewhere's down there. Late 79, sold off probably over 50 or close to 50% of their timber in a lump sum sale. They hit the top of the market, and they got a significant amount of revenue, which at that time they had planned simply to invest for their shareholders so that each shareholder should, if this came to fruition, and I haven't followed it in the last couple of 3 years, it should be receiving a revenue stream of several thousand dollars a year. Maybe there are four. One is Kluk Wan, which is located somewhat north of Haines on the road going into the Yukon. In a land, sort of a land trade opportunity, it's more complicated than that. They were successful in selecting land on Long Island in the south part of the Tongass, and that's some of the finest timber in Southeast Alaska. That ranks with the Charlottes or possibly parts of Vancouver Island. Really outstanding stuff, and they have been successful in harvesting a significant portion of that. Possibly a fourth corporation is the Gold Belt Corporation, and they've had more difficulty doing it, but I think that they would be recognized as being a successful corporation. Now, that isn't to say that these corporations haven't made business mistakes in terms of judgment and decisions, but generally I think they've done pretty well.
In the case of those corporations that have done reasonably well, has it translated into employment for shareholders? Are there native people employed on the operations engaged in logging their timber?
Some, but that's mixed. I would say it's, generally speaking, it's a relatively small proportion. However, that isn't because they haven't made a significant effort to try to provide for shareholder hire. With one exception, the logging operations are contract logging, and therefore the logger can maintain independence as far as hiring practices are concerned. However, without exception, the loggers have wanted to cooperate with the timber owners to try to bring shareholders in. Klukwan owns their own logging operation, and they do not have too many shareholders involved. I think it's been upwards of 15. But that's largely because their lands are located just about as far away as possible from their home community. They're located, as I say, up near Haines and Skagway, yeah. And their lands are down, you know, sort of south of Ketchikan.
Yeah, if Mr. Snippen comes back tonight, I was going to ask him about this, but when Mr. Snippen spoke last night in his capacity as president of SHE Attica, he spoke of the logging operations that SHE Attica wishes to undertake on Admiralty Island as holding out the promise of jobs for Sitka natives, or shareholders of SHE Attica. If this is within your knowledge, perhaps you could comment on it, but are there any special measures that are intended to be taken to ensure that there are native people from Sitka employed in that operation?
Everything I've heard is that that there's been encouragement. And matter of fact, one person who works for Mr. Sippen, Don Sukup, who's in charge of their timber operations, has stated that, for instance, that the logger has even hired a shareholder and is using that person on another operation so that that person will be able to come in in a supervisory capacity once things get going. So my understanding is that there's been quite a bit of effort in that regard. But that's hearsay. There are people who should really testify to that.
Sure. A couple more things. I gather that where there is only a small percentage of shareholders involved in a logging operation engaged in taking off timber belonging to a village corporation, one reason may be that the operation is a long, long way from the village. I assume another reason is that shareholders may not have the skills necessary to be employed. Would you comment on those two reasons and tell me if there are any others that I don't know about?
Well, you certainly hit two of the larger reasons. With the exception of a few of the villages that have their lands adjacent, traveling to the area that's being harvested can cost anywhere from $50 to close to $200. For a shareholder to get there. That's one way. There aren't many shareholders who have had the forest background. However, some real efforts have been made in training. We received the Gold Belt shareholder newsletter, and without exception, every issue discusses the training efforts that are being made to bring shareholders into a skill capacity, and the newsletter certainly infers that they're being quite successful, and I know that's the case in some other areas. But those are certainly the two major ones. Another one is a general lack of shareholder interest, although I think that's changing to some degree. In other words, people are not too interested in picking up stakes and leaving home if the timber is not close by. They are quite interested in continuing to pursue economic pursuits that they've practiced in the past, such as fishing, or they have a regular job at a pulp mill and things along that line. So breaking them away is difficult.
One other thing, Professor Olson at the University of Alaska, Juneau, testified in Juneau earlier this week and referred to what he said was the fact that long-established companies in the forest industry in Southeast Alaska are
subsidized directly or indirectly by the federal government through road building and other such programs, and that the new native corporations seeking to compete with them in the same market have to bear all of these expenditures themselves. Do you have any comment on that?
I don't agree with them.
Could you enlarge on that then?
I've been on both sides in terms of a number of corporations that I've worked for. The way the U.S. Forest Service sets up their contracts is that you bid for stumpage, for instance, and then but you bid knowing that there will be a monetary road construction allocation in the stumpage amount that you bid. Let's say you bid $90 a thousand, and the monetary allocation is stated right in the prospectus, and that's going to be $75 a thousand in order to construct the road. You then go in and you construct the road and generally take out between a third to 40% of the timber that's adjacent to that road. That's been the timber that is designated for that sale. Then you as a bidder leave. I'm not and the road is still there for administrative purposes, and 60% of the timber, let's say, is still there for further sales. The fact that up front the road money is allocated does, in my mind, does not make it a subsidy. The Forest Service could just as easily say, we're going to allow $75 for the road, and you're going to have to build that road to get the timber, and so bid on in that manner. Therefore, you will bid, let's say, $15. It defies my imagination to say that that's a subsidy. When timber is in a deficit situation, such as we have had for the last 2 years, the way the Forest Service rigs this, they say, if you want the timber, you're still going to have to build that road, and however, you're not going to make any money based on our evaluation. But you'll still have, even though you, let's say on this $90 that we were talking about initially, let's say that if you build a road and take the timber out, you're actually going to only recover 60. And so the buyer is assuming an extra risk of $15 if we're using 90 for our baseline and comparing everything to that. And there are buyers who are willing to assume that risk because over the 5 to 7 years they hope that the value will go up and they'll be able to get that.
Well, anything else that you'd like?
No, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Honorable Thomas Arberger, my name is Ethel Staten, and I'm president of the Tsimshian Tribal Association of Sitka. I would like to express my concerns over ANCSCA in regards to the urban Tsimshians. We are Tsimshians who do not live in Metlakatla. We are orphans in the act, in the fact that Metlakatla chose to stay out of the Claims Act. The urban Tsimshians have no land base, have no funding, and according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, we are not a recognized tribe. We feel that we have been left out of ANCSCA and our heritage. The BIA had the trust responsibility to protect our native rights. As a child, I was considered an Indian, spit on, not allowed to associate with white people. I had to sit on the left-hand side of the theater, first 10 rows, and my mother was not allowed into the public school system. We were not allowed to speak our language. My grandfather was the first Native Episcopal priest ordained in Alaska. He was of the Raven clan, and my grandmother was a wolf. My mother is a wolf, and I am a wolf. We were taught to make moccasins and dolls, to carve totem poles and to paint them. And we were also taught to turn the other cheek 70 times 70. Then came ANSCA, and we never had a chance to give our input before the bill was signed between the United States and the natives. Our leaders should have been forced to travel to each and every village and every community to talk to the people, just as you are doing right now. They say Russia sold Alaska to the United States, but it is our land, and all they sold was the right to rule. My mother is 82 years old, and soon all of our elders will be gone without receiving their full benefit of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. She would like her heritage passed on to her grandchildren, as there is too much paperwork. They should not use the 1/4 blood quantum, as an Indian is an Indian. It is our land, it is our heritage forever, and we are a very proud people. Hindsight is great. The native people should have been united and chose their land in one mass, because bit by bit, each corporation will be chewed up and destroyed. The attorneys are the people that are benefiting from our Native Claims Settlement Act. Look at Sciatica Incorporated. We are 13 years into the act, and all we get are lawsuits over our land. Indian is fighting Indian because of outside interests. Congress gave us back our land 3 times, once in the act, once through the Secretary of Interior, and once again when Congress confirmed it. These special interest groups are taking away our Aboriginal rights. But we have all read in our history books about the broken treaties with the Indians. The Act does say without litigation, but that is not true, as Sciatica has been in court as much as 14 times in 1 year. Where is our protection? All natives should be treated equally in our democratic nation. And there should be an oversight committee appointed for the urban Tsimshans and other villages who were left out of ANSCA. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Staten. Could I ask you a couple of questions?
Sure.
About how many people of the Tsimshian tribe are there living outside Metlakatla?
That I couldn't tell you. Mr. Conrad Mather will make a report to you in Ketchikan, and he'll give the full report of how many natives are involved.
I see. Well, thank you very much. Could you leave that statement
could.
With us? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Isabella Brady. I'm a shareholder of Sciatica and Sea Alaska Corporations. The Tlingits, more specifically the Kiksati, have been in this area for thousands of years. The best sites were used for settlements, and for food gathering, campsites were selected and used according to foods being gathered. All of these areas have Tlingit names and were used by specific clans. The purchase of Alaska by the United States from Russia puzzles me in that all the lands owned by the Thlinkets then did not belong to us. Unless we were purchased along with the land, I believe this would be true, because of the fact that the Thlinkets did not have chiefs but were called Thlinket Plains or big men, and was a spokesman only for the clans that they represented, not like the South 48 where you have someone that, a tribal chief. The Thlinket and Haida settlement was settled in order to assist with the all-state land rights, which I think is, should be, instead of claims, should be rights, because this was our land. There was an AFN meeting in Fairbanks during the time that the settlement was coming through, and a young man from Yakutat pleaded with the powers to be of the AFN not to accept the money for the land. His statement was, "We are selling our heritage forever, our land." He said that there was a chief, I think from Yakima, that had asked that we not do this. The dollars were in sight, the excitement was high, no one heard or listened. With the settlement and the 13 regional corporations formed, the total Native communities were in an uproar. Everyone was expecting money. Most of us didn't realize what had happened. What was the settlement for? What was the actual impact? I believe the division of our people, the power, the money, alcohol, drugs used indiscriminately. It was a real big high for everyone, particularly the leaders of the corporations. We are not a corporate-based people. The corporations were confusing. What were proxies all about? The power is with the corporations. They have the money to perpetuate themselves. The so-called dissidents and concerned shareholders worked hard to get board members, and we thought that we could help instigate some changes that we felt were needed on the boards, but the people that were elected on went along with the board members. And you have to have a lot of money in order to run for the board, say, of Sea Alaska or Sciatica. At the annual meeting, some of the concerns that I've heard people mention, one was the high pay of the board of directors, the high pay for those that were working, hired by the corporation. And there were requests made for workshops on corporations. And I realized later that the reason, probably the main reason why workshops have not been given in regard to corporations, because if we began to understand, we could probably manipulate the corporations too, particularly in regard to proxies. We asked for the actual cost that they used to reelect the board of directors. That's never been answered to date. And I know that in the South 48, they actually send people to doors and pick up proxies, and they make telephone calls. And those are high-cost items to deal with. And another thing, they want to know what happens with our elders. Can we give them something before they die? They're going to die without realizing any benefits. John Borbridge was fired for losing $1.5 million. The board lost around $28 million over a year ago. Nothing was done. I believe that the apathy of our people, including myself, as a result of the board not listening to the shareholders and the fact that we really don't understand corporate business. It is difficult to deal with the fact that our corporation is profit-making, cannot deal with our needs, and this is up to the nonprofits. And I know that because of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and ANS, that this is hard to understand for a lot of our people. I think because of the fact we don't understand corporations has caused this to happen. Sciatica's demise has caused apathy with shareholders as well. The fact that someone voted a proxy of a person that had died several years ago is unnerving. We wonder how many other things like this have happened with our corporations. Why can't Angoon and Sitka settle things? The land settlement has caused bad feelings between our corporations as well as the South 48 Indians in Congress. Most people think we are rich and we do not need our public health services, our Johnson O'Malley, our IA monies, social welfare, educational assistance, and this makes it very difficult for us to operate our programs. It has far-reaching effects for us. I was very depressed after listening to the director's report on Sciatica last night. Ignorance is bliss, and I believe this is part of it. The press is used to the advantage of the corporation. They can make it not sound so bad that we lost $28 million because, I don't know, for whatever reason. There's not a feeling of unity with our people. It is possible, I think, that if the shareholders are made to understand the workings of the corporations, we could be of help as shareholders. I am wondering what we've gained by the land claim settlement. I really don't understand the act. I've heard that the way it was written, it guarantees that we will fail, and that what are the ramifications of 1991? I have a feeling a lot of people will sell their shares. I have more questions than answers, and I appreciate this opportunity to share my feelings with your commission.
Could we have the...
I'll have it typed, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Just in here. Tim, my name is Franco Williams, Jr., and I was born in Glacier Bay, raised in Hoonah, attended school through eighth grade in Hoonah, and went to high school at Mount Edgecombe from 1949 to 1953, so I was part of that group that Gil referred to at Mount Edgecombe. I attended Western Washington College in Bellingham, Washington, and spent my military service in the United States Marine Corps. I've been a member of the Alaska Native Brotherhood since 1942. In the older days, our grandparents and uncles who had a lot of influence in our lives usually enrolled us into things like Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood. I was only 7 at the time, but a convention was being held in Hoonah, and my grandparents and my father and all of my family have been active in Alaska Native Brotherhood, especially my dad, who was either the mayor or the city council member in Hoonah for about 40 years in a row. In his time, he probably was considered to be one of the best Tlingit interpreters, Tlingit to English, if anybody in Southeastern. I guess he had a problem with a lot of people who interpret nowadays because they try to convert Tlingit words into English. And my dad used to believe that the best way to interpret is to really convey the message that a person is trying to convey. And that meant you listen to the whole presentation, whether it took 2 minutes or 2 hours, and you represented that message in the Tlingit language. And we have very few people that do that nowadays. I have been a continuously active member in a Sitka NB camp since 1959. I probably am the longest continuous member. There are probably other members who joined Sitka camp before I have, but they sometimes drop out and come back, but I have been a continuous member in Sitka camp since 59. Some of the things I would like to point out are the costs to our people other than in dollars and cents. In my presentation in the A&B, I read a resolution that pointed out some of the things that happened. I'd like to point out some of the other things, maybe from a personal and a people's point of view, that happened. To begin with, and I think all of these things are kind of related, because even though the A&B started the land claims, they also started many other things. And for one thing, they were never a defeated nation. To become part of the United States or Russia, whichever part they were dealing with at the time, was their decision. And to make those kinds of decisions, I think I read the preamble of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. One of the key things among the old people was that opening sentence, and that sentence simply said, "The purpose of this organization shall be to encourage and assist the native from his native state to his place within the cultivated race of the world." Most of the Tlingit people that I knew that helped help establish that preamble could not even speak English. My grandmother was one of them. But she could recite that purpose in her own language. Therefore, one of the things that were really important to the Alaska Native Brotherhood was education. And I'll try to get to that a little bit more in this presentation. But some of the things that, you know, the right for citizenship, the right to go to school, all of those accomplishments I read on the back of the card, all of those things that really did not come free to us. They cost us something along the way. And I think that a lot of people expected that cost would be returned with the Alaska Native land claims. And I think the largest disappointment is that most of it was not. To begin with, like I stated, I was born in Glacier Bay. It was made a national monument. And I and all of my people who were born there, my father, my grandfathers, and all of my family prior to that, cannot even go back there. We even have to get a permit just to go ashore. And now there's legislation to cut us off from fishing. That's one of the best fishing grounds for some of our small hand trawlers who come out of Huna. And now they're proposing to close it off completely, commercially. I guess what I'll try to point out throughout this whole presentation is the number of things that changed for our people from living off a lifestyle of living off the land to an economic lifestyle. And all of the things that were either cut off or limited to us with nothing to replace it. I know that even in commercial fisheries, in the whole Isis Straits area has been shut down for 12 years now, which is the main fishing grounds for the people of Huna. So even commercially, they're being caught on some of these things. This is Huna, and this whole area that you see here is called Glacier Bay National Monument. And the Mount Fairweather area in here was considered the main symbols of our tribe. Almost all of the tribal groups in Huna use some kind of symbols that were designed around Mount Fairweather. And the people are usually considered themselves the Glacier Bay people. Mm-hmm. And this whole National Monument area now is cut off to us completely. And then to add to our problems, they're making the whole Admiralty Island, which encompasses almost the other half of Chichikov Island, is now a wilderness area. And all of those things that they're saying to the Angoon people about fishing rights, hunting, subsistence rights, are the same things they told the Huna people in the 30s before they made it a national monument. But slow but sure, different people change, and whether it's in the state administration or federal administration, or whether whether it's the Forest Service or the National Park Service, people begin to impose other restrictions, other regulations. And eventually, even though I could show the remains of a permanent structure that was built there where we lived, and the remains of a large garden that we depended on. In Glacier Bay. I cannot go back there. And now I cannot even put up a temporary tent or smokehouse in Glacier Bay without getting a permit to even go ashore. See, before, even in my lifetime, even after we moved from Glacier Bay to Hoonah, mostly for things like school and education and stuff, because that's where the school was at, the minute school was over, we used to pack all of our bags and all of our things for the summer. My grandfather had a boat they called the Eagle, and we would move to Glacier Bay. And that's where we would spend our summers. We'd dry fish or hunt or dig clams or whatever that we needed to put up food for the winter. See, we had, money was not all that much to us. I think my grandmother raised six of us because my mother died when I was seven. And her total income for the month was maybe $50. But because we lived off the land, I think we probably ate better and lived better than most people today. Because we knew what to do. We didn't have the restrictions of having to go someplace or get a license or get a permit or have something limited or closed to us. So it's, you know, it's a... I think if I look at the lifestyle today and the lifestyle then, maybe to a lot of the younger people today, it would seem like a very harsh lifestyle, but I thought it was a better one. But nevertheless, things change, and as we gain more recognition as citizens or just as people, it costs us more in our way of life. They're all kinds of restrictions, like the hunting and fishing season, the need for licenses or permits. Even in the fisheries, we have a limited entry system. And if I, like, you take my cousin who has six boys, he's been a commercial fisherman all of his life, and his six sons learned to fish with him. When he died, only one of them could take his license. The other five can never be a boat captain unless they got $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 to buy a commercial fisheries permit. In some cases, that permit costs more than the boat, but you have to have $40,000 to $60,000 just to get the permit. That's not even a license. That's not even the boat. That's not even the gear. That's not even the dollars to operate. So the even though we can talk about Sitka and Hoonah and Angoon, all of the villages were fishing villages, are now growing out of the idea of being fishermen simply because they are losing their permits, or the families, like the one I'm talking about, my cousin has six boys, only one of them has a permit, the other five have nothing, unless they want to be a crew member with somebody else. And just think, when they have kids, those five boys, suppose they have four more boys each, there's still only going to be one permit to divide among 20 to 30 people. And that's the reason why I say we're even growing out of that system, because the permits don't increase, but the families do. And this is part of the thing that I was talking about. Every time we make some kind of advance or do something, then there's nothing to really replace it. You know, they've taken the right away to fish, and yet somehow we have to live. They've taken away the right to live off the land, and still the only thing left is to somehow generate dollars to go to the store to buy something. But actually, when you think about it, you know, it's not only the natives anymore, it's Alaskans. Because almost everything that's kind of decision that has been made in the courts nowadays have taken the position that what is in Alaska does not only belong to Alaskans, but it belongs equally to every citizen in the United States. And that's part of the problems that created the things like limited entry. Whenever any of the Alaskan's natural resources become scarce or is getting depleted, seemingly the first people who have to pay the price that are questioned or have to be cut off are the Alaska Natives, who have used it historically throughout all of our history. Somebody, I think Ellen said something about 5,000 years old, and I think I just read in a paper where they dug up some artifacts that they estimated could be 10,000 years old. But maybe our story goes a lot farther back than that. So the people who really paid much of the price were the old-timers. And even if you get away from the resources and take just education, for example, my father was Franco Williams Sr. He was among the first high school graduating class of Sheldon Jackson in 1921. He died at 88 years old about a couple years ago. He was 27 years old when he graduated from high school. A.P. Johnson and Jesse Price are still alive today. They were also in the class of 1921. But what I was going to point out is, in those days, there were no laws that said we had to go to school. There were no mandatory regulations for us to go to school. We were not even citizens. And in fact, when you look at it, the people who went to school in those days in Sheldon Jackson, they were punished very severely if they spoke their language or if they attempted to practice any of their cultural heritage. Mainly because I think a lot of the times the Tlingit totem poles, their family crests, and all of these other designs that they have were misunderstood by the Christian people who were running it at the time, that maybe the Tlingit people were idolizing false gods and stuff and didn't really realize that this was one of our ways of recording history. So when somebody like my dad came to Sheldon Jackson to go to high school to gain that education, his father and mother knew what the price was going to be. He was never going to be allowed to speak his language or to practice any of his culture while he was in school. Still, he was sent, and he stayed until he finished the highest class they had in that school, and at that time was high school. In fact, they helped create the high school. Prior to that, the highest education was eighth grade. But he wasn't the only one. All you have to do is look at the Alaska Native leadership from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. The only school that they had at the time was Sheldon Jackson, or for a while, Carlisle, and some people went down there. But they also always knew what the price was going to be, and they were willing to pay it, because that was all part of the process. Again, you